Welcome back to the Wine Scholar Guild podcast. I'm Valerie Caruso, a wine educator and podcast host, and today we are bringing you an exclusive interview with the Wine Scholar Guild's founder and president, Julien Camus. Welcome to your own show, Julien.
Hey, Valerie. Thank you.
First, let's talk about where you are. I don't think a lot of people realize that you, along with Celine, run the Wine Scholar Guild from Alsace. I only realized that when I took an exam. So let's talk a little bit about where you are today.
Yeah. So right now we are located in Alsace, in a little village called La Baroche. Doesn't sound really Alsatian, which is just west of Colmar. Above the village of Turckheim, for example, we are really blessed to be on top of the mountain, above the clouds in certain parts of the year, and surrounded by amazing nature, superb vineyards just below, and producers like Zintum Brecht, Albert Boxler, and amazing restaurants and pastry shops. And it's just fantastic to be here after 7 very exciting years in Washington. But at some point, it was time for my wife and I, Celine, to move back to our roots.
You and Celine run the Wine Scholar Guild together as a partnership. How does that work? Do you mind me asking?
No, no problem. So how does that work? I guess the way it works is we sit next to each other, have each 3 screens in front of us, Skype each other, send emails to each other.
Really?
Yes, because the days are so full, so packed with hundreds of emails, with, you know, it just never stops. So, yeah, it's pretty amazing, and maybe we have to find another way, but it's working, you know, not to interrupt each other all the time. We send ourselves email and while we sit next to each other. And that's the way we function.
Now, when you are done, when you pick your little girl up from school, and are you done for the day, or do you spend more time on emails at night when you're not supposed to be working?
We are getting better at separating work and family and quality, you know, family time. So right now, you know, we really manage to separate things. We are not able to do that a few years ago, but it's the only way. We already spend 10, 12 hours a day in front of the computer. If it's to go back to it after dinner, forget it. And we also manage to organize ourselves some moments where we just have to be away from our computers, and, you know, go out to Colmar for breakfast and use that time to communicate other than via emails.
Right. And instead of Skyping each other. So yes. I'm encouraged to know that you're not sitting over breakfast and texting each other on your phones, or you're actually face to face communicating. I think in the future, we'll probably have to interview Celine and get her perspective.
Yeah. Well, if you manage to convince her, she's much more shy than I am. So
it's not
the challenge.
Well, I know everybody that's interacted with her in the past has really adored her. So please give her our best. And thank you for sharing that little piece of your life there in Alsace with us. It sounds like a little slice of paradise. How much time a year do you spend in Washington, D.C. now?
I don't know. It's just a few days a year. I'm actually going next week for 2 days. It's one of the challenges. The team is really spread out. Most of the team is in the US, but nobody in the same location. We've got Lisa close to Baltimore. We have Maurizio working on Italy, who's in Las Vegas. Rick, who's doing all the Spanish-related content, is in San Diego. Lauriane, doing the trips, she's in Philadelphia. So in the end, you know, we took talent where we found it. And I guess thanks to internet today, we are able to make it all work. So, you know, even getting all together is becoming more and more difficult as the team grows.
Yes.
And as nobody's in the same location.
Right. And thanks to the internet, we're able to do this interview. So while the connection is still holding, which is not always the case, let's go ahead and move on to the questions that I've written for you today, because I really think it's interesting the way the French Wine Society got its start. And you actually started it as a way of helping promote and educate about French wine.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time, you were a trade attaché for wines and spirits at the French Embassy.
Correct. I arrived in the US in 2005. I was just freshly out of school. And that was in the middle of a French bashing time when France had opposed the US about invading Iraq and da-da-dee. And at the time, French fries were actually had become freedom fries. And
I remember.
And there was a little bit of a boycott on French wine in the US. So my job at the embassy at the time was to help small producers find importers in the US. And you can imagine when you're in the middle of a boycott period, the importers were, you know, saying, Julian, you're really kind, but that's really not what we need. You know, France keep pushing their offer to us, but we've got our warehouses full of French wine. And what we really need is to pull the demand. French wines are complex. We need to take these wines to people, explain French wines to people and educate. And I couldn't change my job at the embassy, but I said, hey, you know, if I'd be happy to work with you on doing just that. And quickly convinced 25 major American importers of French wine to join. And in a 3.5 year period of time, we hosted over 300 events from big to small, mostly in Washington, but I was also trying to do the same in Atlanta, in New York, in San Francisco. We did also one in Chicago. And I got gray hairs really, really quickly after that. Realize, you know, I was really young and full of energy, but at some point you realize that there was absolutely no way to keep this pace for the next 20 years. It was really, really challenging to do all these events outside of Washington. I mean, the US is a gigantic country. It's almost a continent. And so in front of these challenges, plus there was some frustration, you know, spending months working on major events, and they last a few hours, and all of a sudden it's over. Mm-hmm. It just happened. Everybody was happy, but it's over. It's you know, it's gone, and I really felt this to be really frustrating. So, with all these challenges, we came to the conclusion that education should be our focus. That instead of creating our own chapters throughout the US, we should work with wine schools, with wine tasting organizations that are already in place. And we're lucky enough also to come across the path of Lisa, who had been teaching a little bit for us, wine classes here and there. But at that point, she was available, and we hired her, and you know, she's been with us ever since, and became our education director, wrote the French Wine Scholar Manual, and after that has been overseeing the creation of every single other manual and study program.
And I think for a lot of people, Lisa is the first interaction a lot of us have with the organization.
Yeah, well, she's certainly more of a public face than I am. You know, I tend to be a little bit shy and behind the scene, while Lisa is you know, a superb communicator. So I guess naturally that's how it happens.
And that's why we wanted to chat with you today, because again, I think a lot of your members don't get to interact with you directly unless they're taking an exam, maybe. They might see you, but Celine pretty much proctors all the exams, anyone that's taking a distance learning program.
Not anymore.
I'm sorry?
Not anymore. She's at some point, her schedule was so full of exams that we actually have now two additional persons proctoring online exams.
Okay, so it's been a while since I've taken an online exam. It's been about, 3 years? So, but that was my first interaction in realizing that you guys aren't even in DC, that you're in France. So I think that's probably the only time that was my first interaction with you was during an exam. Like, there you were in the background. And you have actually done so much in the 15 years since you started the organization. And it's so interesting that we descended into politics in the first 5 minutes, because I didn't expect to go there. But your first impression of the American market's appreciation for wine and spirits in general, when you first got here, what was that specifically? I mean, you saw that there was a resistance to French wine for political reasons, but what about overall appreciation of wine and spirits?
Well, overall, I'm not sure, but definitely at the time, in addition to the boycott, the French were completely questioning their model. It was a time when competition from Australia, from Chile, from America, from the US, was rather new, at least at the scale it was, you know, that's when really Yellowtail took off and so on. Mm-hmm. And so French wine was really struggling on the American market, and the French were really wondering, is our model not adapted? Should we, this model that comes from our hundreds of years of history of tradition, should we just give it up to just put the grape variety on the label? And there was really a big push for that. A little bit of this has happened with Vin de Pays d'Oc at the time, but overall, we stayed true to our origins. And with a few exceptions here and there, we haven't changed what French wine is all about. And I think it was the right move, or absence of move, because in the end, yes, French wine is complex, but wine is probably one of the very last products that, yes, has benefited in a way from globalization, because that's how, you know, producer from a tiny village in France can export to the US or Australia, but it's also one of the very last products that haven't suffered from major standardization.
Right.
Why do we get so excited about wine? Because it's one of the very last products that has a soul. And I'm not sure this answers your question at all, actually.
No, actually, it does, because when I was interviewing Andrew in another episode, and he mentioned terroir, and even though terroir can be reflected in other things, in cheeses and products and what have you, we associate it most with wine. And I think the word Andrew Jefford used was a ghostly dream, because by sticking true to that, you've been able to tie wine to centuries of history and culture. And remember, when we all start studying wine, we all start with French wine. That's usually the part that we all start studying when we start learning about wine. We learn the difference between Bordeaux and Burgundy, and we learn what the difference between the blend and the single varietal wines. And that's usually where we start. So I don't think you could have really changed your model, because then it wouldn't really be the wine that we all know and love now, that we're studying it and becoming more aware through the internet. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Yeah. French wine is definitely the place to start. But we were at that point, it was so challenging that some were really advocating that, hey, we need to erase the past and just adapt to how the new world is making wine today. And
right.
Luckily, we didn't. Luckily, we didn't.
Yes, I think a lot of us, now that we've kind of grown into our studies and what have you, because I have to admit, during that time, I was just getting into wine. I knew big Napa cabs. I knew South American wines. I didn't understand French, and I didn't even want to go near it. It was too hard for me. So I was one of those people. I hadn't started studying. But over the years now, 10 years later, you went ahead and you rebranded the French Wine Society into the Wine Scholar Guild. Can you talk about what prompted that branching out into the Italian and soon Spanish wine program structure?
Sure. Well, there are two main driving forces behind that. One is student and instructors. When you hear over and over and over again, oh, I wish there was a program as good as the French Wine Scholar program on the wines of Italy, you know, at some point it does plant a seed in your brain. And then there is the second driving force is probably my entrepreneurial state of mind, and it's, you know, deeply rooted. I love to be an entrepreneur, and would be bored if we were still just doing French Wine Scholar. That's really what students were suggesting it all the time, and at some point I congratulated an Italian person who was living in Hong Kong and who had taken our French Wine Scholar program with a score of, and passed the exam with a perfect score of 100%. And he too said, oh, I wish there was a program like this on Italy. And I said, well, we are thinking about it. And that was Maurizio Broghi, who's mm-hmm. now education director. And when the second I said, you know, we are thinking about it, he insisted so much to come on board and write the program. Didn't feel we were ready for it, but 3 weeks later he had sent me a draft chapter, and it was so good that it became a no-brainer. We, you know, the idea, the seed had been planted in our brain for a while, and all of a sudden we knew we had our guy to write the program, and it's a gigantic undertaking.
Yes, absolutely. And now you're bringing on Ciro Pirone also to teach your online courses. Is that correct?
Well, we always try to bring new talents to our students. We've had e-learning options, distance learning options for a while, but at some point we felt that the flexibility of accessing the course 24/7 and at your own schedule is great, but students actually also enjoy to be on a schedule, to have to be helped to stay on track toward the finish line, and that new format of online instructor-led programs with Sharon for French Wine Scholar, with Ciro for Italy. Alan Tardi also has been teaching Unit 2 of Italy. He's really the best of both worlds, the flexibility of e-learning with a schedule and real instructor to assist you and help you get to the finish line faster.
And I think what's great about these programs is everybody has to identify their best way of learning. And that's something that I'm always curious about, is the way people learn. And I'm actually a big proponent of being self-paced. I learn well on my own. You know, I don't need to be on a schedule. I schedule myself. And so I did my diploma that way. I did the French Wine Scholar that way. I did them. Well, the Master Level Champagne, you had the lectures, but you recorded them. So mm-hmm. if you missed one, you could go back and look. And I think that that's an important asset to have too, that if people miss a lecture, they can go back and look at the recorded lectures that Lisa did for the French Wine Scholar, et cetera. So you actually appeal to a variety of learning styles.
Yeah, we try. And we try hard to have all kind of materials within a single program. You know, there are e-learning modules that we try to be really, really interactive, because a lot of people learn by doing things. So, you know, when by dragging items on a map, by
active learning. Yes.
Yeah. Active learning by creating some flashcards, whereby you know, it's like cards, the real cards, but you've got the question on one side, you flip it, you've got the answer. If you had it right, you click so that it goes on the easy stack, and if you had it wrong, you put it on the hard stack until the hard stack is empty.
Okay.
You know, these are really tools to help you integrate the information.
Right. That's really accommodating for a variety of learners, which is really cool. And I think I want to go back to the Spanish Wine Scholar program, because that's coming on board soon too.
Yeah, we are. We sent the study manual to print yesterday.
Congratulations.
It felt amazing to click on order now.
Yes.
Because, you know, it's been over a year that Rick and Lisa and everybody, but of course I'm involved in many steps as well, I've been working on this project, and sending the manual to the printer is really a celebratory moment. So right now we are in the pre-launch phase, whereby we have in which we have about 120 wine educators from all over the world. Some of them from our current program provider network, but also some instructors from new schools in new places in the world. Also some major companies like regional monopolies that distribute all the alcohol and wine in certain markets. The education persons are in the program as well. So from now until this summer, we are in a pre-launch just for wine educators, and by September we'll have all the e-learning modules and activities ready and be able to have a full launch for the general public through our partner school network and online, so for September.
So you have a lot of resources available on your website, and you bring the cultural aspects of learning, is such as pronunciation, immersion trips. What are you the most proud of?
What I'm the most proud of is probably not the website, is even though we have some great tools, mostly the member webinars to me are priceless. They allow you to learn from top people in the wine industry, from geologists to sommeliers to area experts. But what I'm the most proud of are the study manuals. When I sent yesterday the Spanish Wine Scholar manual to the printer, and seeing it from that very first version, the quality of the depth of the text, the quality of the illustrations, of the maps that Quentin Sadler has done, compared to, you know, how much time it took us initially with the first program, the French Wine Scholar program. We have learned so much from this initial experience that now we are with the first edition, sending something extremely strong and thinking that in just a few months from now, it will be in the hands of and studied by students in over 60 schools in 30 countries and 5 continents. I think that's really what I'm the most proud of.
I think what also is striking is I'm going to tell you a little story about your study guides. And I was in an Italian restaurant and they had a copy of the Vino Italiano book. It's an older book. It hasn't been updated, but I said, oh, isn't that a great book? And the woman who runs the wine program says, yes, I wish they had one for French wine. And I remember saying, oh, I had just gone through the French Wine Scholar program, or I was just getting ready to or whatever, but I had the book. I knew I had the book. And I said, well, this is my go-to for, you know, just basic French wine knowledge, because there is no other book that's so comprehensive and current as far as French wine. And I turn to it again and again, even though mine's a bit old, I still look at it for, you know, it's a good starting point. So I would suspect the same would be the case for the Italian Wine Scholar books and then the Spanish Wine Scholar books.
I think it's even more true for those because in the end, there is so much already written about French wine, probably not covering all of France in such depth and detail, but there is a lot of literature on French wine. On Italy, there is less. And when it comes to Spain, it's been a real challenge for Rick to collect all the information. Of course, it doesn't know everything, so you've got to do some research. And there has been so much written about French wine, so you've got a lot of sources that may be conflicting, but there are sources. For the wines of Spain, it's a whole different story.
Your Italian Wine Scholar program, now that actually comes in two volumes versus one volume.
Yes, indeed. When we were about to, you know, starting to look at how we would create the Italian Wine Scholar program, there was no way to be at the level of depth that we are for France, for Italy, and make it all fit in a 275-page manual. So we either would have to compromise and be much less comprehensive than we wanted, or, and that's what we opted to do, we opted to cut the program into two manageable chunks of information. So two units, unit one, Northern Italy, unit two, Central and Southern Italy, with two separate exams. And yes, it probably makes the program more daunting. You know, there is that bigger barrier to entry. But on the other hand, if you really want to learn about Italian wine in depth, we thought it was the only way.
Right.
And we actually see really good results in terms of examination. You know, when the amount of information to absorb is more manageable by cutting it into two pieces, we actually have some pretty high pass rates. Maybe also a lot of the students who have failed French Wine Scholar may not feel ready for Italian Wine Scholar, and so we only have kind of the best of the best doing Italy.
Right.
But the pass rates have been really, really strong.
Really good. And then Spain is going to be one volume?
Yeah, one unit.
Okay, one
Spain,
unit.
The manual is already over 300 pages, but in second edition, once we go with the official launch by September, will probably be a little shortened. We notably went a little long on some history sections, but it's going to be only one unit. When you think about it, there are so many fewer appellations in Spain than there are in France or Italy. In the end, it should be quite manageable from a student perspective.
And I'm kind of curious because these programs are relatively new. Italian's been out there for a while, but Spanish is just launching. Would you see master level programs for the Italian and Spanish wine regions on the horizon like you have for the French?
Yes. So the next master level program is still going to be French. And that's also for this fall, end of September. We are going to launch probably our last master level program. And this is for the Loire. We are finishing to line up all the speakers. The lead instructor is going to be Pascaline Le Pelletier. That's a name that some of our listeners may be familiar with now, because she's had quite a lot of press this year. She already was a master sommelier. She's from the Loire Valley, working in New York. And this year she became the first female to become a MOF, which is Meilleur Ouvrier de France, mm-hmm. in sommellerie. So it's an extremely hard title to obtain in France. It's a little bit like an MS, but our French version of it. So she was the first female to earn that title this year. And just a couple months later, she became the first female to become French Best Sommelier. So we're extremely excited to welcome her this fall to lead the Loire Master Level program. And normally 2020, we should be able to launch the Piedmont Master Level program.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, Spain, that's going to come later. We're also working on a Master Level title. I'm not exactly sure how to, we've got an idea. We haven't communicated on it yet, but basically a title for those who would have covered all the French Master Level programs.
And you do have quite a few people who've covered them all?
A few. I mean,
okay,
all of them. There are not that many people, but so they are definitely in competition to be among the first to earn that title.
Well, I can imagine if I had unlimited time and resources, I would probably be trying to do the same thing. It's like, oh, I want to do them all. They're fun. But, you know, it's always not always possible. But I'm glad that there are people out there that are really trying to learn all these regions in depth. But we're getting to the part of the interview where I ask everybody the same question. And this is your question, Julien, that we inflict on all of our interviewees. So it's your turn. If you were a wine, which wine would you be and why?
All right. Yes. And inflict is really a correct word.
Yes. This is all your fault. Yes.
I found it amazing how easily I could, you know, think I know which wine my wife would be or Lisa would be or, you know, but when it's for yourself, it's actually much more difficult. I've been thinking and, you know, it's between what wine you think you would be or would like to be or actually like. But I think I would be something like a Savagnin Houillé from the Jura. More precisely from the Sud Revermont, so that's the southern part of the Jura. Why? Because there are a handful of producers in that kind of remote, out-of-the-way area of the Jura that produce amazing wines, both in, you know, Chardonnay, Sauvignon, reds as well. But so I'm picking that particular area for this reason. And you know, it's really unpretentious, an unpretentious area. Yet the wines have a lot of backbone. The producers that I'm thinking about, they are natural wine producers, don't necessarily talk too much about it, but they don't put any sulfur, work in biodynamy. The wines are unfiltered. And yet, you know, despite the fact they are natural, they're extremely precise, sharp, complex. And I guess wines of tomorrow, you know, when you see how people are have lost trust in the food industry in general and in any chemical, any additive, mm-hmm. In all our food, I think that the wine of tomorrow is going to be natural in a way. So I guess that's the wine I'd like to be.
Now, is that a wine that we can get in the American market so much? I'm only saying that because I'm in the American market. But is that a wine that a lot of people can get their hands on?
Well, from the top producers, it's becoming really, really hard to find because the Jura is becoming really hype. Plus, there were three vintages in a row of a very small crop. But you could hunt for example, a Fleur de Savagnin from Julien Labbé, Labet, of course, from this area in the Sud Revermont. You could also be looking for one of the Savagnin Houillés from Jean-François Ganva. If you can put your hands on them, they're becoming really, really hard to find. Then there are a few other producers like Domaine des Marnes Blanches in that same precise area. And I think the very best thing to do is actually to plan for a trip in the Jura.
There you go.
End of March, there is this Nez dans le Vert, V-E-R-T, so Nose in the Green, which is a trade tasting of all the organic, biodynamic, natural wine producers of the Jura. It's always unpretentious, but so exciting. And there are some amazing restaurants in that area. I just, you know, that's when we have a few days to escape, that's where my wife and I go.
Very nice. I can see a trip to the Jura, or, you know, a guided tour with Wink Lorch or something like that. That would be amazing. Is there anything else you would like to add before we wrap up here as far as what you're looking forward to later this year or anything you have going on?
Well, all the details yet have to be found out. What I'm excited about is at least the idea for our 15th anniversary symposium. We don't know exactly when. We don't know exactly when, except that it's going to be somewhere in 2020 in France.
Oh.
We used to host our symposiums at the French Embassy in Washington, but as we are becoming more and more international, it doesn't make sense to expect students of us from London or from Hong Kong to travel to Washington, D.C. for the Wine Scholar Guild Symposium. And I think being in France, where, you know, in wine regions of France is really what we should be doing. So in 2020, we will be hosting our 15th anniversary symposium, but have everything yet to organize and figure out.
Okay, so that's something to look forward to. They're every 4 years, right? Or 5 years. The other one was 2016, correct?
We started every year.
Okay.
And quickly realized that we are spending half of the year working on the symposium versus creating study materials, study programs, and taking care of our students. So it has become an event that we are going to do every 5 years.
5 years, okay.
To celebrate the 15th anniversary, the 20th anniversary. And I don't even want to think further than that.
Okay. Okay. No, I appreciate you answering the question. I know we had not planned that, but it's something exciting to look forward to. Mm-hmm. And listeners, we have to thank Julien for giving us some time today because, again, we don't often get to hear from him. So thank you so much for joining us on your show.
Thank you, Valerie, and thank you, everyone, for listening.
And for more information on everything we talked about today and the programs and the trips and to keep your ears peeled for the 2020 symposium, go to wineschollarguild.org.